First, as we wrap up this long holiday weekend and really kick off summer, you and your family may have plans to get to a local amusement park in the near future. Think Bay Beach in Green Bay or Little America in Marshall or any one of the numerous options in the Wisconsin Dells. While you may think of amusement parks as more of a recent phenomenon, our next guest says there's actually a long history behind them, alongside a cast of colorful characters who made them possible, and their story is often wilder than a roller coaster ride. Steven Silverman joins us now. He's a journalist and author, and his new book is The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. Steven, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. My subtitle is so long, I was afraid it would take up all the time.
Oh, but it's so fun with the rhyming and everything, and anything right. that involves dreamers and schemers we're all about.
I wanted it to sound like, almost like a huckster's pitch.
It does, kind of.
Chanting Coney Island.
Well, what is it anyway. About amusement parks that has captured our attention for so long a time?
I think mostly, and today it's particularly pertinent, reality can be difficult, and these are ultimate escapes. And I mean, you can break it down when you walk into them. Theme parks, in particular, they'll grab a theme and give you an immersive experience. You know, you're not in your everyday world. And then, you know, if you get on a roller coaster and it's climbing a hill, you're not thinking about paying the mortgage. You're thinking about getting off this thing safely. So it just takes us out of ourselves, and they've worked. And, this has gone on for a good century as far as the American amusement park is concerned.
And why did you feel drawn to research and write about the history of these amusement parks?
It's very simple. I don't know if, you know, there's no deep, dark mystery. As I grew up in Southern California, Disneyland was my playground, and I loved it. It wasn't a place you could go every day. You really had to convince your parents to take you there because it costs more than the local merry-go-round. But I thought, you know, what happened before Disney? I had done a book on the history of the Catskill Mountains, and the publisher said, you know, what do you like? And instantly it was Disneyland. But then I realized this goes way back. This goes back, you know, to medieval times and Renaissance fairs. And I wanted to know who was responsible and how did it all come together? And I, you know, you start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. And I pinpointed it to 1120. There was a tragedy in England. It was the Titanic of its time. The heir to the throne, Prince William, went down trying to cross the English Channel. His father, King Henry I, was in terrible mourning, and he had a jester who was quite the opportunist and convinced the king that Saint Bartholomew had come to him in a dream and rescued him from a monster. And that they needed to pay tribute to St. Bartholomew. And that's how Bartholomew Fair started, originally as a cloth fair and religious pageant, but it soon evolved, or possibly devolved, into fun and games. There was entertainment, there was food, and there were even very primitive rides. And those are the three ingredients that one requires to put together an amusement park. And it went from there, and certainly, you know, came the mechanical age, the amusement parks really gripped the imagination.
So the Bartholomew Fair back in the 12th century, you say, you know, is a pretty clear precursor.
Starting point.
Yes. So you actually say that at its peak, that the event was a 3-week version of Coachella. How raucous did this thing get?
Oh, very. I mean, what initially killed the thing after 700 years in the 1800s, it was just too raucous. It took place in a portion of London called Smithfield. That's where Dickens set Oliver Twist, and that's where Fagin and Bill Sykes committed their crimes. And it was a really rough area. And, you know, the city elders just wanted to get rid of it. It was a giant outdoor whorehouse. For lack of a more genteel description.
So not exactly the Magic Kingdom.
Not yet. Well, in a way. But at the same time, more refined cultural pleasure gardens were taking shape. There was Vauxhall, and that's at the standard for pleasure gardens all over the world. In the major capitals, and they even came to the colonies, Vauxhall Gardens, and it was a place people could go in summer because everything depended on weather. And they, again, these were escapist places. Ice cream was introduced in these places. Fireworks were introduced in these places. Wax museums. These were hot stuff. And slowly, rides were introduced. What really gave footing to the American amusement park, because there had been rides. The roller coaster really came from Russia. It was a wooden sled that Catherine the Great even liked. And then the French took it after the War of 1812 back to Paris and added wheels, and that's how it became a roller coaster. And it didn't transfer across the Atlantic. Instead, Americans came up with a roller coaster. It was one fellow named LaMarcus Thompson from the Midwest who, in 1884, opened up a 6-mile-an-hour switchback railway in this raucous resort called Coney Island. But it was really the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, the Midway, with the introduction of the Ferris wheel and other rides that showed, you know, entrepreneurs and dreamers and schemers, this could be a viable business opportunity. And that's what really gave the footing, the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
We're talking with Steven Silverman right now. He's a journalist and author, and his new book is The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. And you just mentioned the financial aspect of this. They really represent a pretty big business these days. What kind of economic numbers do we see with amusement parks?
Oh, 500 million people went last year. The Wall Street Journal reviewed the book this weekend, glowingly, I'm relieved to say, and noted that income from amusement parks matches the gross national product of New Zealand. But they were always big business. These things were what I also learned in my own research, because I didn't know any of this. At one point, there were 2,000 amusement parks in America in 1910. And don't forget, this was our mass entertainment. Movies weren't around yet. And these things, if you had a town of more than 20,000 people, you had an amusement park. And they were basically all the same rides. They were manufactured either in Coney Island or in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, because there were so many amusement parks for the steel workers in Pennsylvania. But these things were owned by the trolley car companies. The trolley car companies were owned by the railroad barons, and they put these trolley parks at the end of the line. So, because during the day, the men would go to work in the factories on the trolley car. At the end of the day, nobody was riding the trolley car, and yet the railroad barons were still paying for the electricity and on weekends. So they would put these amusement parks at the end of the line, and men would take their wives and their children, and everyone went there.
We're talking with Steven Silverman, author of the new book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Do you have plans to go to an amusement park this summer? Do you have a favorite? What do you enjoy, or for that matter, not enjoy about those places? And what questions do you have about their history and how the concept of the amusement park developed over time? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Stephen Silverman is with us, and we're talking about his new book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. And amusement park fans, we want to hear from you. What is it about those places that keep you coming back? Is it the rides, the attractions, the thrills, or something else? Where's your go-to amusement park? And what questions do you have about how those places came to be? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Stephen, I want to touch on something that I found really interesting. You say that amusement parks throughout time have done one really big thing, that is they integrated the social classes. And I have to say, I'm sure it was true in the Middle Ages and a couple centuries ago as it is today, that people from different social classes don't tend to mix. Tell us more about how they did that.
Well, originally, I mean, it was part of the founding principles, almost, whether they meant to do it or not. But they, you know, Bartholomew Fair was a free-for-all. But then with the more formal, the Vauxhall Gardens, there were rules that the aristocracy, which did frequent these places, were not allowed to bring their servants in. And the servants were allowed in to roam on their own. They were not to be at the aristocracy's, their masters and mistresses beck and call. So it was, you know, conceived as fun for all. And, you know, again, when you're on a roller coaster, it doesn't matter how much money is in your pocket. If you're going to scream at the top of your lungs, you're going to do it, no matter whether, you know, you own the factory or work in it.
Let's go to the phones, and Roger in Elgin, Illinois is up. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi,
well,
Roger.
I've got an interesting comment. My grandfather came here from Germany in the 1870s. He came to Chicago. He happened to be an architect, so it was a perfect timing because there was a great fire in Chicago. And he became friends with other German-American men and that were pretty influential in those days. Of those, Oscar Mayer was one of his friends, another man named Wilhelm Schmidt, and became good friends, and they had a German veterans hunting club that was on the north.
I know where this is going.
Chicago. And William Schmidt's son went to Europe and came back and told his father there were some great things that they were doing there were amusements. And so William Schmidt said, well, we have some vacant property there where we hunt. And they decided to put up that amusement park that is well known and long gone, but Riverview. So,
that's in my research.
Friend.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Stephen, go ahead.
The son modeled it after he had been to Copenhagen and seen Tivoli Gardens, and he had been to Vienna and seen the Prater. And said, Dad, we should do this here. And that is what happened. And Riverview closed in 1967. That fact still brings tears to the eyes of people in Chicago.
And I will say it was near where I grew up, and my parents talked about it because it closed only a couple of years after I was born. So I didn't go, but it was talked about frequently.
It is still revered, and it supposedly had the best roller coasters.
Well, thank you so much for that memory, Roger, and going back to a little part of my childhood history. Let's go now to Stuart in Green Bay. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I'm just calling to just make a comment. I had, when I was in college, I did a course. I had an English course, and my family owns a small carnival, and I'm third generation in the business. And I posed basically 20 questions, and they asked three different eras and their takes on certain objects and how things have changed throughout the years. And knowing that there's only so many carnivals, traveling carnivals specifically, not necessarily amusement parks, mm-hmm. that are in the state, but most of them are actually just family owned and have been passed down through family. So I was just wondering, as far as amusement parks go, have most of them been passed down through family?
Great question.
There are very few still owned by families because they're very expensive to maintain, but they're and insure. and, you know, corporations, this being corporate America, corporations have stepped in. Six Flags bought up a lot of family-owned, but there still are. And one of the great ones is in Pennsylvania, Knoebels. That's strictly family-owned, and there are still some, you know, throughout. The Wisconsin Dells, those parks, some of them are family-owned, of course. But in terms of large-scale amusement parks, you know, the Disney family did own Disneyland for a long time, but that's now a publicly held corporation. So it's tough these days for families.
Thanks for that call, Stuart.
You also have to remember that one ride can cost $100 million.
Wow. Wow, that's quite an outlay for anyone, but
yeah,
especially a family.
Right.
We're talking with Steven Silverman right now about his book, The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Steven, you introduce readers to many of those dreamers and schemers who brought amusement parks to the masses. And one of the people in your book is P.T. Barnum, who played a huge role in the success of the circus in the late 19th century, and including here in Wisconsin. How important were promoters like P.T. Barnum for amusement parks?
Well, what he did before joining the circus, he had in New York, oddly enough, very close to where I live, it was Barnum's American Museum, and it had the spirit of an amusement park. It was sort of Barnum land. It had odd exhibits. It had constant entertainment. There weren't rides, but he kept the crowds coming in and going through, and it was his sense of showmanship. And he invented the billboard advertisement.
Really?
I mean, he contributed mightily to the culture and help speed along the development of the amusement park.
Wow. And it sounds like there was a fair amount of overlap of the techniques that he used for an amusement park and what he then used for promoting circuses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, he never lost his sense of hucksterism. Much of, you know, he was his own best publicity agent because he made up so much of it, but it was nonstop. And, you know, he called it ballyhoo. You know, it's all, and yet it was done with whimsy. It was amusement. You know, the mechanical rides came later when there were machines and the power to make them go around.
Well, let's talk about those rides a little bit. I think today those are definitely a real cornerstone of an amusement park experience. I have to say, you know, especially at like maybe a carnival or something on a little, I don't know, cheaper scale, you can wonder about the safety
right.
of the rides. What was it like in the early years? How much attention was paid to the safety?
Not enough. when there was a roller coaster at, again, the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, and some workers, there were six workers who went on the test run. Well, one of them was killed. They, you know, it snapped. The car snapped apart, and one of them went flying off the track, and it was severe. There were also instances. I was very careful. My first draft of the book was a little more grisly, and I took all that out. I thought, wait a minute, this is about amusement parks. But there were cases. I mean, you know, sudden hurricanes would hit, and a Ferris wheel would topple over into the nearby lake or river, and people drowned. There, safety was always an issue. It's still an issue. There is no state or federal regulation of amusement parks.
Wow, I
it's
didn't realize
that. It's brought up every summer. I shouldn't make it a blanket statement, but there certainly is not enough, and it's an issue that always comes up.
So let's jump to today. It seems like the trend in amusement parks is to out-extreme the competition or even,
right.
you know, your own park from the whatever was being offered a couple of years ago. What are some of the attractions that exist today that really push the boundaries of what our bodies can handle?
They are tested. You know, let's just deal with the two sort of Florida parks. You know, Cedar Point has the most roller coasters in Sandusky, Ohio. And those are, you know, those are extreme machines. But Disney and Universal, the Harry Potter ride in Universal is a little rough. I mean, you can get motion sick. And it was always, and they have giant roller coasters at Universal with movie themes, but they're basically roller coasters. And that, it's a different audience from Disney. Disney is a family audience. It's for kids and their grandparents. You know, they offer you adventures. But to compete, Disney is giving you more thrill rides. Universal is adding another roller coaster because this summer Disney, very soon, is opening Star Wars Land. These are mega. These are amusement parks unto themselves. I mean, the Harry Potter Land in Universal, there are two Harry Potter areas, in fact, and they keep expanding because the public comes, and by next year, they want a new dose of it. They want a new version, and, you know, the market will bear it. The prices go up, so does the attendance figures.
I just heard that Euro Disney is actually expanding. They're adding another section to it. So it seems like amusement parks are here to stay and are still really good business.
People still love a communal experience. There's no getting around it. Yes, the lines can get too long. And yes, the prices are outrageous. But it's I don't mean Universal Studios. It's a universal phenomenon. I just came back from Tokyo and Shanghai, and the Disney parks there are extraordinary. And you need reservations to get in.
Wow. Wow. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to research this fascinating history and for sharing it with us today.
Judith, thank you.
Stephen Silverman is a journalist and author, and his new book is The Amusement Park, 900 Years of Thrills and Spills and the Dreamers and Schemers Who Built Them. If you're a fan of amusement parks, you can go to the Ideas Network Facebook page, tell us your favorite, tell us if you're planning on going soon, and give us tips for the best way to enjoy it.